Good evening, everybody, and welcome to this final plenary session of the conference. I'm Steph Lawler. I'm one of the conveners of the Social Identities and Social Divisions stream. I'm very pleased this evening and honoured to be able to introduce our three plenary speakers who will speak in order for about 10 minutes each. And then if we could invite comments, discussion points, or questions from the floor. Our speakers this evening are Michael Banton, who's Professor Emeritus at the University of Bristol, has had a long and distinguished career, was, I believe, the first editor of Sociology. He's well known for his work in race and ethnic relations. Satnam Verdi is Professor of Sociology at the University of Glasgow. He's the author of Racism, Class, and the Dialectics of Social Transformation, and also of Resistance, Racism, and Radicalism, which will be published by Palgrave next year. Les Back is Professor of Sociology at Goldsmiths College, University of London, the author of The Art of Listening, and is currently working on a completed project with Samsha Sinha on new hierarchies of belonging, and has a forthcoming article in the European Journal of Cultural Studies, and they also have a book on the project coming out. I won't detain you further. I'm going to hand over now to Professor Michael Banton, and then the speakers will each take 10 minutes, and then we'll hand over to everyone else. Thank you.
To qualify for a PhD or to get an article published in a good journal, you have to make an original contribution to knowledge. You have to find something in existing knowledge that you think you may be able to prove unsatisfactory. This is the first characteristic of the approach from critical rationalism. Its second tenet is that knowledge grows when researchers find and in some degree solve intellectual problems. Thus, in 1967, John Rex and Robert Moore spotted that accounts of race relations in British cities did not allow sufficiently for the outcomes of differential positions in the housing market. Their analysis of housing classes stimulated others to demonstrate how the housing preferences of South Asian settlers differed from those of local whites, and why they differed. This led next to research into how housing markets operated. You start from problems, not from concepts. You judge concepts by how good they are at helping you solve problems. You have to contribute to sociological knowledge. Therefore, you have to use sociological language. I remember a time when I went to my dentist and said, "I have a pain in my tooth there." And the dentist looked in my mouth and said, "That's what you think." And he explained to me that pain is an impulse coming along a nerve, and that when a nerve gets to a ganglion, it sometimes jumps tracks and gives you a false report. I had described my symptoms in ordinary language. He used some technical words that expressed technical knowledge. For us, one model is Durkheim's study of variations in suicide, in rates of suicide. He developed a new kind of knowledge and vocabulary, and explained these variations by reference to relationships of which the people themselves were not conscious. So the third characteristic of the critical rationalist perspective is the distinction between different kinds of knowledge and the use of different kinds of concept. Marxists distinguish phenomenal form and essential relations. Others distinguish folk and analytical concepts, or emic and etic constructs. Words like racism, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and multiculturalism are ordinary language words with multiple meanings that are important in ordinary speech and in political discourse. For the purposes of sociology, we need concepts with single and stable meanings, as Max Weber said. So critical rationalism's fourth characteristic is its commitment to methodological nominalism as opposed to essentialism. In my paper, which is on the study group's website, I show why other perspectives contribute less to the growth of sociological knowledge in this field. This is no abstract dispute. I contend that a conscious adoption of the critical rationalist perspective should promote better research. And the example I give is in the study of preferences for association with co-ethnics.
Thanks, Michael. Perhaps I could, we were all allocated 10 minutes. I think Michael's taken approximately three, so I might decide that I want to take up at least another five of those minutes. I want to thank the BSA, Stephanie, and members of the BSA Race Forum for the kind invitation to speak here this afternoon. It's a real pleasure for me, given that I'm joined on this panel by Michael and Les. Given the shortness of time, I will try to be very concise with my sets of arguments. As I understand it, Michael is seen here as representing a strand of critical rationalism. Les, the perspective of cultural studies, without doubt now, I think, the dominant paradigm within British racism studies today. And whilst I'm here to represent that old dinosaur of historical materialism. Now, given how little time we have then, I want to proceed immediately to my differences with Michael's position. Before turning to offer some thoughts on Les's work and cultural studies more broadly. Out of this, I hope what emerges is a greater clarity of the value added that a Marxist-inflected account of racism could bring to currently dominant understandings of racism. So if I turn then to Michael first and critical rationalism, as I see it, I think there are three fundamental and irreconcilable differences between an account of racial and ethnic relations informed by critical rationalism and an account of racism informed by a historical materialist perspective. I think these centre around epistemology. They centre around what the parameters of our field, what we understand the parameters of our field to be. And thirdly, I think it's the place of values, the place of values in sociological research on racism. Now, like Michael, we've been kind of engaged in a debate in ERS, and I've already commented, I think, in quite a lot of detail on those first two dimensions. So what I want to focus my attention on today is this third dimension, which is especially important. And when I was thinking about this, I came up with kind of three titles for this section. The place of politics in racism studies. I thought this was sufficiently neutral. To keep everyone happy. But then I thought, you can't be neutral on a moving train. And then I eventually decided on the marvellous Max Smith in sociology, the marvellous Max Smith being the famous Max Weber. Now, for me, I can't accept Michael's Weberian-inspired insistence on a value-free sociology and the search for something called objective knowledge. And we only need to point to sociologists, sociological Marxists. Take Alvin Gouldner, for example, 1962, 50 years ago to this month, who wrote that in opposition to Weber, that there is, and I quote, and there is and can be no value-free sociology. The only choice is between an expression of one's values, as open and honest as it can be, this side of the psychological couch, and a vain ritual of moral neutrality, which, because it invites people to ignore the vulnerability of reason to bias, leaves it at the mercy of irrationality. So by making this link explicit, I believe we can get a better grasp of what we commonly accept as objective knowledge in sociology. And the point that I want to make about this notion of objective knowledge is that it's actually deeply scarred by the racializing and Eurocentric presuppositions of its founding fathers. I want to illustrate this with a concrete example concerning Weber, because Weber is the person that Michael seeks inspiration from. So take the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. Weber here conceives of a Europe that is fundamentally hermetically sealed off from the rest of the world, leading him to understand the genius of Europe as lying within its own boundaries. Now, principally, as we all know, this is the elective affinity that prevailed between the Protestant work ethic and the inclination to accumulate capital. That's why, and I've tried this over many years, one searches in vain for any systematic consideration of the impact of slavery, colonial oppression, imperialism, and in understanding the overdevelopment of the West was at the expense of the underdevelopment of the rest of the world. But such a Eurocentric account of modernity should not come as a surprise, I would contend, if we explore the values of Weber and the values particularly that he held at the time that he was producing this kind of knowledge. And my contention would be that this jars very much with this marvellous Maxmyth that has prevailed in sociology since the Second World War, particularly in the English-speaking world. In Wendersiekel German society, riddled by irreconcilable class conflict and the threat and then actuality of war, Weber has been described by his most important biographer, Mommsen, as a liberal imperialist, an imperialist with an extremely strong attachment to a racializing German nationalism. It's these sets of values, I would contend, that lead him to develop the kinds of analyses that he does. Take, for example, the concept of foreign infiltration. Now, you'll have to excuse my German, but Überfremdung. This is derived directly from his 1892 study on Polish seasonal workers from Russia and Austria, who'd filled the vacancies created by the labour migration of Poles in Prussia to the Ruhr. Now, Weber warns explicitly against what he calls the Polonization of the east of Germany. He also calls for Lebensraum, living space in the east, by annihilating Poland. Immediately after World War I, he wrote, along with Thomas Mann, a letter to the German press complaining about the presence of French colonial troops in the German Ruhr. And what was the source of this angst? The dangers of race mixing. So the dangers of race mixing and the harm that it would do to the vitality of the German race. Now, I could go on and on and on to document the widespread racializing discourse throughout Weber's works, including the general economic history. My point in this instance is not the racism per se that I'm especially interested in. It's rather that such a narrow outlook blinds Weber, I would contend, making it impossible for him to conceive of two key points. One, how the exploitation of the racialized other directly contributed to the rise of the West, and two, that if it wasn't for that racialized other, and I'm talking here of Africans, Arabs, Jews, and Asians, there would not have been a European Enlightenment. So in terms of his values, Max Weber was a racist, a nationalist, and an imperialist, like most liberals were in Europe at the time. Sociologists, I would contend, still have not come to address this fully in their work. Now, by making these values explicit, no one should be surprised that the knowledge that he produced, especially the account of modernity and the rise of the West, was Eurocentric in nature, and that this knowledge then reinforces the marginalization of the non-European contribution to human civilization. My point then to Michael, I'm sorry for this digression, but I think it's important. My point to Michael is this then: by continuing to find ever more elaborate reasons to break this link between values and the production of knowledge, what he does is deny how deeply implicated liberal bourgeois culture of the time was in the production of racist knowledge and in justifying its own superiority. What Weber's work does, I think, is offer a gloss, albeit a very sophisticated gloss, to the chattering classes of Europe about why Europe is the hegemon of the world at that point in time. In my view, such objective knowledge is racist knowledge, given the way that history has unfolded since 1492. Michael, by continuing to adhere to this position, is mistakenly assuming that liberal culture is some blank, race-neutral canvas upon which, through reason and observation, those twin pillars of the Enlightenment, some kind of objective knowledge about racial and ethnic relations can be produced. I just think this is naive. And it simply lets the dominant institutions of liberal culture off the hook for creating the racist knowledge and the structures of domination over the past 500 years. In my view, the only way to challenge and contribute to the undermining of this dominant narrative that reproduces the hegemony of the West is by producing knowledge informed by an anti-racist and internationalist class standpoint. That way, I would contend, we contribute to the development of a counter-theory of modernity, which begins at least to unsettle those shackles of orthodoxy that I think continually impede the development of a better and more informed sociological understanding. I'll leave it at that. I have other points that I could raise about Michael's paper, but I think that's more than enough to be going on with. Well, if it's okay, Les, I want to say something. I want to turn to Les as well. I think this is incredibly important. As far as I'm concerned, I think the areas of divergence and disagreement between historical materialism and cultural studies are not fundamental. That's certainly my view. Or perhaps let me put it this way, they're not irreconcilable. I think there are many areas of commonality between the historical materialist account of racism that, for example, I've produced, and the kind of work that Les has developed so skillfully over the years. And I think the same would also apply to a number of other prominent individuals within British sociology, including John Solomons, Paul Gilroy, Claire Alexander, Caroline Knowles, and many others whose work I read with great interest and with very much, with a great deal of respect. I think one of the reasons for that commonality, I think, is because we share an intellectual lineage. And that shared intellectual lineage is in the form of Stuart Hall. I think at the same time, one cannot deny there are also important differences between the approaches taken by Les and myself, which to my mind are also the fault of Stuart Hall. And the reason for this is because I think it's which Stuart Hall we find most productive to think with. So put crudely, and I apologise to this to Les in advance, the Hall he seeks inspiration from is the Hall of new ethnicities and the one who tries to understand how we can live with difference in the modern world. Now for me, as a Marxist, it's the Hall of the late 1970s and the early 1980s. I'm thinking here in particular of Policing the Crisis, but also those two very important but hardly ever read essays these days, Race, Articulation, and Society Structured in Dominance, and Gramsci's Relevance for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. Now, it's my firm belief that anyone interested in developing a Marxist analysis of racism, especially one that seeks to study racism in conjunction with questions about class and social transformation, has to engage critically with the theoretical innovations and insights produced by Hall in this period. That rich intellectual legacy bequeathed by Hall in the late 70s and 80s was instrumental, I would argue, for the next generation of scholars who used it as a foundation to transform our understanding of racism and the multifarious ways in which it worked within Britain. Think, for example, of the brilliant collectively authored The Empire Strikes Back, Gilroy's There Ain't No Black in the Union Jack, and Solomos's Black Youth, Racism and the State. At the same time, some of this work, I would contend, especially Paul Gilroy's, comes to represent a rupture with Hall's original aim of producing a Marxist analysis of racism, what he called a Marxism without guarantees. Now, in that paradigm vacuum that's created by the decline of Marxism in the early 1990s, This vacuum is filled in racism studies by the post-Marxist, post-structuralist Stuart Hall and Paul Gilroy of New Ethnicities and Understanding Difference. Also, think of Les's own excellent New Ethnicities and Urban Culture. Now, I would contend there is a moment of rupture at that point in time. And since the mid-1990s, within what was called race and ethnicity, cultural studies accounts of racism have grown exponentially. And I would argue now they're absolutely the dominant paradigm within Britain. Now, there's no doubt in my mind whatsoever that this work has contributed to a richer, more nuanced understanding of racism than we had hitherto. The understanding of racism and its relationship to nationalism, to gender, the state, and many other areas of social life have been incredibly important contributions which have added to the knowledge base that we have. At the same time, however, and this is where I think I begin to differ and move away from the positions that have been developed in recent years, is that these gains, I think, have been accompanied by still unregistered silences that hint at the uneven and partial nature of the knowledge that we've accumulated thus far about racism. And it's here, as I said, that I begin to depart from the positions of my cultural studies colleagues. And I think any serious accounting of the balance sheet of cultural studies must take into account these silences as well as the undoubted gains. So I want to illustrate again with a concrete example. And I'm speaking here of trends. So again, I apologise in advance if you think I'm oversimplifying, but I think since the 1990s, research within racism studies has focused increasingly on the cultural at the expense of the economic, on the theory and politics of recognition, multiculturalism and understanding difference, rather than the theory and politics of inequality and redistribution. Gone from the lexicon of cultural studies are sustained accounts of racism and its articulation with class, and the historical evolution of capitalism in the age of globalism. In fact, concrete as against abstract discussions about class, the economy, and historical capitalism, I would contend, have simply vanished, constituting today merely a memory of how work was done in the 1970s and 1980s. And reflecting this altered state of affairs has been the almost wholesale abandonment of the workplace and its institutions as a legitimate site of study to explore how racism works. And of course, if you get rid of the workplace, the workers have disappeared too, black, brown, and white. So key questions about the role of capitalism in perpetuating and sustaining racialized class divisions are no longer the focus of research as they once were. And I think with devastating consequences for political projects seeking liberation from capitalism. One author recently has reflected on this process more generally and concluded that there is now a growing consensus, and I quote, on the political left as well as the right, that capitalism is an untranscendable horizon. I think it's imperative then that at this moment we pose the question, how on earth did we arrive at this position in racism studies? Especially given the fact that the original source of so much of source of inspiration for so much of this work produced in racism studies over the past 20 years was Stuart Hall. I think Hall himself recently has registered how what he calls the two halves of late modernity, the post-colonial on the one hand and global capitalism on the other hand, have kind of proceeded in relative isolation from one another. In fact, he's gone on to pointedly refer to those who, in their zeal to counter the disastrous theoretical and political effects of a certain economistic reductionist kind of Marxism, have contributed, and I quote, not alternative ways of thinking about questions relating to the economic and their effects, but instead have engaged in a massive, gigantic, and eloquent disavowal. Now, I'm not at all suggesting that the focus on the cultural, including cultural politics, has been misplaced. Rather, that it has been a major failing of cultural studies inflected work, that culture was not brought into play alongside an analysis of the political and the economic. The failure to do so, I think, has been detrimental and hindered the formation, I think, of a more nuanced and a richer understanding of the totality of racism. Terry Eagleton, I think, has put it really well recently, reflecting on his own work over the past 30 years, where he said, culture does not go all the way down. It's not wall to wall. And I think this is the space within which historical materialism can make its contribution. I think it can do this by further enriching existing cultural studies accounts of racism. I'm certainly not suggesting a reworking or a rerunning of the debates of the 1980s involving Paul Gilroy, Bob Miles, and many others. But I do think that historical materialism, and I mean here a Marxism focusing not on philosophy and culture, but a Marxism focusing on the critique of political economy and political action, can highlight and bring into view certain kinds of questions and provide answers to those questions which current dominant paradigms within racism studies cannot do. Why? Because historical materialism as a theoretical frame, a mode of working, but also as a political project, can't be reconciled with historical capitalism. It's its theoretical negation. It names capitalism as the seedbed for the production and the reproduction of global inequalities, including racialized inequalities. Just think, I'll conclude with this because I've taken far too much time, but I'll conclude with this. One of the most important gains, I would argue, of the anti-racist movements of the 1970s and early 80s was the opening up of public sector employment to racialized minorities, as well as women. Throughout the dark years of Thatcherism and Major, it was this development more than any other that sustained and arguably improved the employment position of racialized minorities and helped create a highly integrated British working class in these particular areas. Yet these gains are under threat, as they are for women. Why? Because of capitalism, because of the systemic crisis facing capitalism. So what I would suggest is that I think we need to, within racism studies, re-engage with some of the key concepts within Marxism studies, class, crisis, and capitalism. And that way, I think, we can further enrich the accounts provided by our cultural studies colleagues. I'll leave it there.
Well, you know, it's good to stand in as a sort of surrogate target for such esteemed people. And often when I find myself in the company of sociological colleagues, and I consider myself perhaps fantastically a sociologist, perhaps that's my own sort of, you know, delusion, but I don't know that I subscribe to the idea of being named and corralled into this category. I know sociologists often talk about cultural studies as a mild insult, but I'll suffer that for now, to be honest with you, because it's important in a way, I think, to say from the beginning that, and it hasn't been said already, I think all of our kind of collective imaginations have been limited by a kind of closing down of the kind of argument that we're trying to open up today. And I think that's an important and a positive thing. That's why I'm happy to be here and to be involved in this discussion. Du Bois also brought Weber to Atlanta, didn't he? He was a kind of complex figure in this story, or the relationship, or both the kind of political complexities of the formation of sociology. And one of the things which I think is important that Michael has signaled in his recent work is the prediction that Du Bois made both at the dawn of the 20th century and a few years later, so extraordinarily, in The Soul of Black Folks, that the key problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the color line, has reached a point now, I think, where that metaphor is no longer as useful as it once was. And I think Michael is right about that. I think Michael is also right when he says that he's deeply skeptical of the globalization of American racial technologies. I don't just accept the caricature, which I know is a necessary one, of the relationship, my own relationship to Marx and to the kind of legacy of historical materialism, or for that matter, the kind of break that you imply, I think, between both Stuart Hall and Paul Gilroy in relation, and John, for that matter. Where is he? Oh, yeah. You can speak for yourself, mate. But I don't see that, actually. I understand the point you're trying to make. I mean, I think in a sense, you know, so much of these kind of analytical and political and epistemological arguments that we're having today are really important. But the other thing that I think is equally important, I would say even more important, is the degree to which our kind of collective analytical repertoires are equal to the complexities of the way in which racism as a scavenger ideology is unfolding in our time now. And you know, we had a great session this morning about C. Wright Mills, and there's one passage in Sociological Imagination where Mills says, you know, you shouldn't have more than three pages of a written text without an example or a concrete example. And I'm going to try and give you the most concrete example that I know. On the outskirts of South London, there's a huge public housing estate called New Addington, a place where all of the working class communities of that South London borough were located during the slum clearance of the 1950s and 60s. It's become notorious recently, which we'll come back to in a minute. It's where my mum lives. It's where I go every weekend to visit her. And over the last few years, every week I go onto the estate and pass this this memorial to Lance Corporal Paul Knight, who was killed in 2007 after a 6-month tour of duty in Iraq, where he was involved in some of the most intense and fierce fighting there. You know, another sign that's on that roundabout often is a sign for the local moneylender, Captain Cash. You know, it's a recruiting ground for the army. It's a place where young working class men find themselves being drawn into an involvement and an implication in geopolitical interference elsewhere in the world. It's also the place where the young woman, where there's been so much controversy about, Emma West, would have driven past as she rode on the tram from Central Croydon to where she lives in New Addington. My tram experience is kind of racist diatribe where she says repeatedly, "My Britain is fuck all," has been watched by over 10 million people. She is being prosecuted under Section 4 of the Public Order Act. Her case comes up in June, I think. And anybody who's read the Public Order Act Section 4 closely will know, and then watch that video, that it's very likely that she will be prosecuted.
Convicted?
Convicted, sorry. Forgive me. At the same time, I think this is the best guess now, some 333 people have died in police custody without a single conviction. Now, I suppose what I'm trying to do, you know, Paul Gilroy famously wrote a book called Ain't No Black in the Union Jack. Here we have the name of a black soldier serving in Iraq written in black across the Union Jack. You know, where does that tram go? It ends in New Addington. It passes this memorial, which is a sign to me of a kind of different geopolitical scale with regard to trying to understand issues of racism, belonging, and so on, than perhaps we have been thinking about in the last 20 years or so, and the importance of trying to connect those interventions those operations, the war on terror, and the logic of securitization with the discussion of racism. And there's this young woman, voicing a kind of crude popular racism very publicly. And the tram finishes and goes past the areas that were the places of severe urban unrest. This iconic image of the last summer's riots of a young woman jumping out of a burning building. We learned later was an Eastern European migrant. Okay, why am I saying it? Well, I'm giving this as a kind of series of signals, I suppose, of things that are crackling around in the political culture. I'm not sure we do have the kind of repertoire to make sense of these, if you like, symptoms of the kind of challenge and the problems of our current moment. Certainly, I think Michael is right that the problem of the colour line is kind of too much a link to a moment that seems to have now passed. Stuart Hall said at the dawn of the 21st century, maybe the problem of the 21st century will be the problem of difference. I'm sure we will have an interesting argument about that. But also, I think, as well, a question that I'd like to put into the mix of our discussion is that perhaps the lines that are being drawn on a different scale and in different ways. It seems to me that what's emerging in our time are new hierarchies of belonging. There can be no going back, Stuart Hall said recently, to the kind of nostalgic view of British society as a kind of white island, or series of islands. There can be no going back. Well, if there's no going back, maybe what we're witnessing is a kind of reordering or an ordering of difference along a kind of hierarchy of belonging, an unstable one. And how then do we understand the way in which the positioning of those steps, if you like, of belonging and inclusion that are contingent, that are unstable within a larger geopolitical scale? It seems to me that invites a serious and careful examination and analysis of the way in which some differences can be included and other differences are too much of a difference. And I think work by people like Liz Fikiti in the book Suitable Enemy and Gargi Bhattacharya's Dangerous Brown Men are examples of precisely trying to make sense of that. The way in which Islam figures in the kind of history, the scavenger history, if you like, of racism as an evolving, shifting, unstable force. And how that connects to ways of policing the current crisis. I don't see, Salem, at all a break between, in my own thinking at least, the Stuart Hall of policing the crisis and the kind of things that I think are important now. Perhaps we've just lived through the most archetypal moral panic of recent times. Wasn't the unrest in the summer an extraordinary moment of crisis policing, really? Perhaps, and what I thought was so interesting about that, and I'm sure you'll all disagree with me on this, is the degree to which, there was a kind of disjuncture, in a sense, the bit you'll disagree with me is after this, between the extraordinary disavowal amongst the political elite that those events were anything to do with issues of race, inverted commas, or racism. Complete, extraordinary, choreographed disavowal. The story on YouTube told a very different tale. One of the postings, the other thing I thought was interesting about those events was the degree to which they were being documented in real time by people who were in those crowds. And then there would be a whole series of responses to those posts and to those films. One put it, the return of the real Planet of the Apes. The rhetoric of race alive and well. And perhaps David Starkey, this is the bit you'll probably disagree with, did us at least one big favour in that he punctured that kind of choreographed disavowal in his open connection and his open citation of Enoch Powell and Another Age, when he claimed that the problem was, of course, it was a cultural problem actually, that the whites were now black. You know, something about the importance of trying to make sense of the complexities of racism, I think, in the midst of that, that are really, you know, crucial in our moment. You know, Gary Dobson, one of the men from Eltham who was convicted of the Stephen Lawrence murder, he revealed recently, you know, a kind of penchant for black music. His son was a kind of devotee of 50 Cent, the rapper. How do we make sense of these? Well, these complexities, I think, are problems and puzzles in our time that need to be understood culturally and can't be reduced, you know, to in a kind of crude way. And I suppose in a way what I'm trying to argue for is not a choice between the immaterial or the economic and the cultural. Yeah, I think that's a mistake to say, well, actually all this cultural stuff, not that interesting, not important. It's what people do in their day jobs that's important. And I think in a way, the lesson that I took from Paul Gilroy's work when I first encountered it, it's funny to think of it as a dominant paradigm now, maybe I'm just getting older, is that I think that book, Ain't No Black and Union Jack, what it did was to sort in to open up the possibility that, you know, perhaps we're not most free, or the potential for kind of emancipatory kinds of mobilization or agency is not at its height when we're at work. Now, I think you're right about the stark choice. I think it's a mistake to make a stark choice. And perhaps we should have thought more about the importance of keeping open the sort of spheres or sectors, if you like, of social life, rather than prioritising either trade unionism and the workplace or reggae dancehalls and records. No prizes for guessing which category I was in that particular thing. So, you know, it seems that, you know, I think this is very important in a sense then, to think about the kind of agency or the politics, if you like, the transformatory politics, so I think you're so committed to, within different kinds of spheres, and different kinds of spheres that aren't kind of reduced to a kind of muscular sense of where the important stuff happens and what kinds of politics is more important than another. The nursery as a place for what Gilroy calls a kind of conviviality, something important happening at school in terms of, you know, the emergence of a kind of anti-racist or a non-racist kind of social sphere. And of course work, and of course you're right about that. But the thing is that I'm confused about, and I'd like any of, you know, the minds in the audience to help me with this, is, well, is the kind of form of class structure that was so important in the moment of those historic events at Grunwick the same as the kind of structured economic workplaces that we have in our moment now? And my hunch is that I don't think they are. I don't think they are. And I think what we need to try and think about then is how to kind of think about the relationship between class, the economic sphere, and racism. Because I don't see in Gilroy's work at all a turning away from the implication of the politics of race and of capitalism. The book Darker Than Blue makes it so stark. I mean, he's such a kind of trenchant critique of corporate multiculturalism there that seems to be all about that kind of legacy of his relationship to Marxism. Okay, now, I would love to believe in the transformatory political power of a kind of the working class as the grave diggers of capitalism. I would love to not only sit in my study, but to go to Croydon every weekend and sit down amongst my family and friends and believe in that transformatory power. But I just can't subscribe to that. That sense more. It seems to me that Mills was right, actually. The people who are really a class for themselves are the elites. They're the ones. who exercise class power. You know, I suppose in a sense, I'm not saying that, you know, I'm sort of foreclosing or turning away from that, from the idea of some kind of transformative project, but it's not the one, I think, that we learn on the pages of Marx. I don't think it is. Now, what happened this summer when the rule of law withdrew in the cities, in cities like London? What happened when the police pulled out? At a moment of freedom, young people went shopping. They taxed, they got paid. You know, and there's something as well that I think, which is it's a sort of, not just trying to get a cheap joke or a cheap jibe, but you know, what has the kind of culture of consumerism and consumer capitalism done to the kind of political imagination in our time? To an idea of what freedom might be? Because I think Bauman is absolutely right when he says that those events were riots of consumerism or of disaffected consumers. You know, disaffected consumers in the midst of highly racialized stop and search policies and invasive police interventions in those youthful communities. Okay, so I'm going to shut up now because I've had my time. I suppose in a way what I'm searching for, or trying to think about, or trying to sort of work with or work towards, is a new set of repertoires, analytical repertoires, to try and meet the complexity of what I think is a sort of sets of issues and problems that have kind of got away from us analytically. I don't know if anybody else feels that, but that's how it feels to me. So in a sense, that I think that's why it's welcome for us, rather than to go over old arguments and debates, to think about how kind of reactivating a conversation might help us, you know, develop a kind of successor paradigm or series of paradigms or tools or resources that might help us meet that challenge. Okay, thank you.
Misread Weber's, as I think American sociology, and probably Michael, I'm afraid, as much as I respect him, have misread Weber's notion of value freedom. I don't think Weber, I know that's the epithet that's always attributed to him, but I think if you read really carefully what he says about particularly the practice of sociology and how truth emerges, or actually, in my view, for Weber, truth doesn't emerge, perspectives emerge, some of which might be more plausible than others, and his criteria for plausibility are miles away from science. So, you know, I would put myself in a camp which takes a lot from Weber, takes a lot from Marx, takes much more from Stuart Hall, and I think the problem for your exposition is the complete dismissal of the basic truth of the kind of post-structural term, which is uncertainty, which we mainly associate with Bauman. And I don't mean, you know, the collapse of grand narratives, because clearly you're still promoting a grand narrative, and lots of Marxists still are. But I think you've got a major problem of actually asserting a kind of certainty for a historical project, which, for all its intellectual power, has hit the buffers. And as an ex-Marxist, you know, as a kind of post-Marxist myself, I think we have to face that. And I think it's I think think it's really, particularly as a, you know, talking to students and young people about this, I think you just have to start from that appallingly disheartening occurrence. I'm not saying it, that the class struggle has gone away. I'm not saying that clearly what we're experiencing actually now is a massive resurrection of class power. But the forces of opposition in the West have clearly transformed themselves. And it's in that sense that I'm with Les on this. I think that you have to take that uncertainty and that complexity much, much more seriously. And you have to, we have to find a much more complex and a much more nuanced and a much more humane, a much more sexual, a much more gendered kind of language for the oppositional movements that are emerging. And frankly, orthodox sociology has failed to do that. Orthodox Marxism has failed to do that. And the only really creative forces that I see around myself, see around us, are those who, broadly speaking, however lumpy the category is, are in cultural studies.
Can I come back?
No, I take those comments on board, but there's a sense in which Max there is effectively dumping every kind of critique and asking me to then account for the tragedies of a certain kind of orthodox Marxism. I made very clear that actually I reject that kind of orthodox Marxism and that I reject it through that productive engagement with Stuart Hall and that work. So, for example, I think one of the points I would make in terms of defending historical materialism is the way in which sociologists, cultural studies sociologists, have elided one kind of Marxism with the many Marxisms that have existed over the last 120 years. And there is that diversity. And with that diversity has also been the issue of uncertainty. Lenin, for example, you know, someone that you will not hear in sociology classrooms, is precisely rebelling against that kind of evolutionary account of Marxism that prevails in the Second International, Walter Benjamin. So what I'm suggesting here are there are resources of critique within historical materialism that actually can further enrich the cultural studies accounts that have been produced thus far. I'm not suggesting an absolutist one or the other. I'm suggesting there are issues that have been missed. There is complexity in the workplace that is missed in the accounts that we have of race and ethnicity in Britain today. There are moments, for example, of multiculture that you talk about and Paul talks about, which are incredibly important. But one of the points I would make is that the workplace is actually one of the sites where that kind of multiculture works and actually is a site where the conditions for a more emancipatory politics may exist. But I'm certainly not wanting to be placed within a kind of orthodox Marxist camp.
Sorry.
My work, I think, would testify to a rejection of that orthodoxy. You know, so I'll leave it at that.
No, see, I think, in a way, what...
Les, would you find...
Your thoughts? Come now. I mean, I think there's two things, big things that you find are lacking, and I think there's in that whatever cultural studies became, and it became many things actually, I think, but it seems that, you know, that kind of, it seems the way in which the priorities of what was important, where cultural politics was really happening, turned away from the workplace. And I think you're absolutely right about that. And, you know, perhaps unwittingly or not really not realising that actually... But, you know, when I think of conversations that have been had in other rooms, it's not as if those kinds of formations, if you like, of a kind of convivial class culture, if you like. I mean, that's the other thing as well that I think is important, is that maybe what Gilroy tries to give us is a way of thinking about a kind of sphere in which, you know, you can't be reduced to singularities. I think you're right on that, and maybe that's what we need to be thinking of know more carefully now. The privatising of different spheres of the political world.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's a really good comment for Les. I really appreciate the way that you framed your comment. Unmuscular way in which you seem to be very much trying to keep open the space for dialogue, it's important. So I hope this doesn't come across as a muscular response.
You go on then.
I'm not convinced that the people in the riots, in those images, were going shopping. Maybe because I know this sounds facetious, but they weren't paying for anything. You know, they were healing, or they were taking the opportunity.
Yeah.
In that moment, it seems to me, to act some kind of revenge.
Yeah.
To call them frustrated consumers implies that when the system lifts off its heavy hand, all they enact is some kind of conformity with the system. But that's not what they're doing. I'm not saying there's a great moment of hope represented there, because that would seem to be kind of ridiculous, but there was certainly a profound kind of negativity.
Yeah, that's right.
And I do think there's a danger then of turning that moment into evidence of triumph of conformity. I think it profoundly was not that.
No, and I don't think that's what I intended. I was being provocative, to be honest with you. I was being provocative. So your response is well put. No, I mean, I think a lot of things about this, and I was trying to be provocative just in the sense of, well, what were those? And I certainly wouldn't want to be drawn into the kind of just unhelpful nostalgia about how much more political the riots were, you know, in the last century. Stupid, in my view. Stupid and nonsensical. But one of the thing that I suppose it is important in my mind is the science of those kinds of revolts, if you like, or refusals, the targets of them.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not going to say this is really about shopping, it's not around politics, of course not, I'm being provocative, but at the same time, I think the sites are significant, and then, you know, the thing, the most sort of profound the thing that made me think hardest was a YouTube video that I saw of a JD Sports at the end of my street where I live. You know, a guy standing there with a mobile phone, filming people going in and coming out with boxes and boxes of trainers. Very young kids going in there, and older people too. And this young man standing there, recording this in real time. And there's a kind of commentary running. And he says, so one of his friends comes up and says, oh, can you see how young that boy is there? And he says, yeah. He says, well, are you tempted to go in? And he says, yeah, I'd love to go in there, but you know, I'm a working man, I can't afford to go in there. And then the young woman says, I work in a nursery and my criminal records bureau check is really precious to me and I'm not going in there. And it seemed like in that one moment there was a division being kind of, division unfolding between those whose future was worth less than four pairs of cheapish trainers and those who had more to lose, you know. So it's not, I'm saying that there's something very complex unfolding there.
Should we say that?